The colonization that took place in Africa was not the same colonization that took place in Asia. The colonization that took place in Nigeria was not the same colonization that took place in India. Specifically in West Africa, modernity that people usually collapse into colonialism was not brought there by colonialism. So again, we're talking about agency. We're talking about taking history very seriously.
Diese Stimme gehört Femi Taiwo. Femi Taiwo ist Professor für afrikanische Politik und Direktor des Zentrums für Afrikastudien an der Universität von Cornell in New York. Im Zentrum seiner Forschung steht die Dekolonisierung in Afrika, über die er mehrere Bücher geschrieben hat. Die Bücher verlinken wir euch in den Shownotes, aber jetzt gibt's erstmal eine Lecture von Femi Taiwo. Für uns referiert er über die Frage, wie Dekolonisierung funktionieren könnte. Die Lecture, die du gleich hörst, hielt er im Januar 2023 im Südpol in Luzern. Bevor es losgeht, aber noch ein Hinweis aufs nächste AHA-Festival. Das findet am 26. und 27. Januar 2024 im Südpol in Luzern statt. So, jetzt geht's los. Viel Spaß mit der Audioversion dieser Lecture.
Thank you very much and welcome to this session. I would like to start by thanking Christoph for this generous invitation to be part of this festival. As I said to him and as I told everybody else, when I got the invitation, I said, well, I don't do science. And then he said, well, I read your book and, you know, this is something that we think we might want to share with you. And I never say no to any learning opportunity, because this is exactly what it is, a learning opportunity. And when he sent the timetable and he said it's going to be at 10:15, I said, oh, you do that too? And he said, yes, we do. And I said to him, I said, another learning opportunity, I am in your hands and I trust you. And here we are. So thank you all very much. I would also like to thank Anna, you know, who works with him, who I got to meet today, but who generously volunteered to be part of getting me here where things were looking rather down. And that always touches me. And Vanya, who fed me this evening. And Pavel, who has made sure that I look like a rock star with all this on my ears. Yeah. So it's a great team, and I'm really happy to be here with all of you. I would also like to thank those of you present here for checking me out and spending this time with me. And where I'm concerned, the audience is everything. And I say that as a teacher who always tells his students, don't come to class if you don't enjoy hanging out with me. The only reason I want you here is because you think that being in the space with me and having the conversations help you. If they don't help you, don't come here out of a sense of duty. Stay away. So I'm really happy when I do have an audience, and my job is to make sure that you don't regret this time that you're never going to take back spending it with me. So please come with me. My talk tonight is based on my recently published book that Christoph just kindly showed you. What I propose to do is to describe the basic thesis of the book, why it should matter to you, and why were we to take seriously what it converses, a lot of the conundrums that we encounter in our discourses concerning Africa and its peoples will be resolved, if not disappeared. But the title of my talk is not the title of my book. So now to the specific title that I chose as the preferred vehicle for doing what I just announced. What has decolonization got to do with it? Let me put my watch in front here so that I can watch the time. What has decolonization got to do with it is a riff of two hard copies and one piece of music. A sports equipment corporation, which I remain nameless, demanded of us to, quote unquote, just do it. Have you ever wondered what it is that we are being instructed, goaded, or entreated to do? Does it matter that we do not know what it is for us to do it? On what grounds do we base our belief that it, quote unquote, will be something good for us? And for whatever it is whatever any one of us thinks it is, does it, then have any meaning beyond our individual quirks. But I'm sure that many do it in the belief that what they are doing is convergent with what many others are doing. So that's the first copy. Let's move to the second. Many years ago, a beverage company, which I also remain nameless, I will name them if they pay me. It's an ad, so I'm not going to give them an ad for free. That's it. So if you're a fan of the beverage company, you can write to them that they could have done better if they had paid me. A beverage company ran a hugely successful ad campaign, and it goes like this. The beverage company's name is it. That's it. That was the coffee. Talk about genius phrasing. X is it. Is the it in our first example? As in, just do it. Or is it a different it? It does get around, though, no doubt, because I think they kept that ad for years, you know, before they retired it. And then we have Tina Turner's smash hit. I have to mention Tina Turner's name. Otherwise, I won't get to heaven. So it's the only reason I'm mentioning it. She's that big. What's love got to do with it? There goes it again. I would like to suggest that the strategic ambiguity of it in all these occurrences is what gives it its appeal. Its insane popularity and the disposition of most, if not all, who receive the messages they convey to believe that they all know, without knowing, I suggest, what it is and what it means, and they are perfectly all right to keep deploying it, doing it, and providing numerous but really convergent answers to what the heck it is, does, means, when it comes to love, life, and everything else. I would like to share with you tonight that the ubiquity, popularity, and near necessity of deploying at the present time in academia and various intellectual circles of the word decolonization, or its variants, decolonizing, generally mimics the situation that I have just described. No, I am not trivializing decolonization. After all, colonization draws in its wake its negation, which is decolonization. And the particular colonization that took place in Africa, and I need us to pay very serious attention to this, was unusual and qualitatively different from the colonization that took place in some other parts of the world. And I'm talking even of those that were also colonized by Europeans. Let me put it concretely. The colonization that took place in Africa was not the same colonization that took place in Asia. The colonization that took place in Nigeria was not the same colonization that took place in India. And there may lie some of the answers to the questions that people have. India too was colonized, but they are doing well now. So how come Nigeria too was colonized, but it's not doing well? And that gives rise to all kinds of racist answers, you know, that people love to give. And when you use colonization in an almost monolithic way, you abridge all these differences and you end up actually doing injustice even when you don't mean to. And the one that took place in Africa, again, was not singular either. there were at least three types of colonization that took place in Africa when it comes to European colonization of Africa. One was settler colonization. South Africa is the best example of that. Kenya, Zimbabwe, Zambia, and France at Algeria were good examples of that. But the interesting thing in the case of South Africa is that the original settlers, Afrikaners, Boers as they were called, did not colonize the people there. They colonized the land. They wanted the land, and that's similar to what happened in the United States and Canada. And we need to bear this in mind. Then the British got there and colonized both the natives and the Boers. And then, you know, all other things began to happen. Then there was settler cum exploitation colonialism. So we had that in Zimbabwe. We had that in Kenya, some parts of Uganda, you know. Yes, in Algeria too, it was settler colonialism, not settler versus exploitation. It was when the natives could not be moved that attempts were then made to turn them into, to create a breadbasket, you know, Algeria. And then, of course, we know what happened there. And then there was exploitation colonialism. And I have done all this in a completely different work, which people just find convenient not to talk about, and that's okay with me. But these distinctions are very central to part of my argument against decolonization, you know, and I'm going to share that with you. Exploitation colonialism did not mean to do anything for the colonized, except just extract from them and take it out of there. So if you find any kinds of attainments that were made while colonialism lasted in those parts of Africa where it was exploitation colonialism, it was not because of colonialism, it was in spite of colonialism. And that brings me to the other part that people don't pay attention to. Specifically in West Africa, modernity that people usually collapse into colonialism was not brought there by colonialism. Modernity was brought there by Christianity. And at the time when that started, Christianity and colonialism had not become one. That happened in the third, in the last third of the 19th century. And again, we need to pay very serious attention to these historical timelines. You know, in fact, formal colonialism that everybody now associates with the decolonization industry in Africa did not start effectively until after the Berlin West Africa Conference of 1884-85. Which means that in most parts of Africa, there is no place there where colonialism lasted for more than 100 years, if that. And that is part of my beef about making colonization or colonialism the singular pole with which we periodize the history of Africa. That cannot be wrong, that cannot be right. It has no historical support, and it is actually a sign that you don't take African history seriously. And that, as you all know, is not a fault only of foreigners. It is the way that we African scholars also tell our stories. And unfortunately for us, I've just written a new piece where I specifically attacked that pre-periodization. And I actually asked that we should get rid of the word pre-colonial from conversation about anything African, because it does not add a single iota of illumination to our understanding. So these are very radical claims, and they are claims that I hope that we have people take on, and then we can argue. Although colonialism and colonization and related phenomena go way back in human history and experience, the colonization in Africa, the immediate object of focus in my book, was of a particularly virulent and violent, hence destructive type. In fact, one of the reasons that decolonizing is such a powerful motivation for the constitution of the discourse that I criticize is precisely that people look at the continent and see so much continuing desolation, destruction, and hopelessness, which is rife there, that they are convinced that the winning of independence from various colonial powers had not been of consequence, because colonialism never really ended. Quite the contrary, they see a continuation, possibly causation, you know, of the old harms of colonization in the contemporary period. From this has emerged what may be styled a decolonization industry. It is a global industry that draws stakeholders from both ex-colonized and the ranks of their colonizers. What unites all of them is that they are convinced that such is the continuing impact of colonization, that the business of decolonization must progress apace, maybe even be intensified. Such is the broad sweep of this industry that you can hardly find any phenomenon now that is not under or a candidate for some kind of decolonization or the other. I am almost certain that some may have written a piece on, quote-unquote, the need for decolonizing, how to boil water. Is that popular? So this is what has led me to the analogy with, quote-unquote, it, at the beginning of my talk. When somebody announces a talk on decolonizing menstruation, and another calls on us to decolonize nursing, and yet another wants to decolonize Western political philosophy, and now, this should interest us gathered here, decolonizing mathematics. I hope no one thinks it is out of place to ask our decolonizers what exactly they are doing and are expecting us to be doing. What is it that unites all those four things I have just mentioned? And how does colonialism affect anyone or all of them together? That is what I mean by when you throw decolonization around and everybody throws it around and everybody to whom it is thrown around pretends that they know exactly what is being thrown around, we end up with the it. So that's the connection between my title, you know, and decolonizing. So when I ask, what's decolonization got to do with it? It is an attempt to force us to take another, a closer look at the facts we are invited and are inclined to say yes to. And when we are in crucial business of informing the world, educating generations, as is my responsibility as a teacher, our purview must rise above that of those who are shilling for the bottom lines of the corporations that pay them to come up with compelling ads that prey on our common inattentiveness plus vulnerability to guilt. I am contending that the idea of decolonization and the discourse that it has engendered has entered into this territory. It is catchy. It sounds okay, morally good even, and has a boilerplate simple quality to it, that the surprise would be that anyone thinks something may be wrong with it. On that note, welcome to my world. Yes, there is an awful lot that is wrong with it. As I have said in other places, the decolonization industry is retarding scholarship in and about Africa as I write, and it is in so doing creating a situation where future scholarship will be nothing to write home about. I actually think, and I've said this in an interview, that what its promoters are doing when it comes to young scholars borders on the criminal. To avoid the ambiguity that afflicts the term, I have differentiated between two meanings of decolonization in the book. Decolonization 1, subscript 1, which originally meant a process by which a colony that is under the control of another country becomes an independent, self-governing entity with its political and economic fortunes under its own direction. And I make clear, under its direction, not necessarily under its control. And what is crucial here is that where that control is, how that control operates, is no longer severed from the direction. So as long as a country remains under colonialism, as Amilcar Cabral wrote, it is practically denied the privilege of making history under its own agency. Whatever concerns the country is done by the colonizers, and sometimes they may pretend that they ask the opinion of the colonized, but more often than not, they decide what is good for the colonized and go ahead to do it. Let me use an example from the book that people don't pay attention to. My original homeland, Nigeria, got its independence in 1960. It was only after independence that it was discovered that the government that took over had signed a secret defense agreement with Britain that will allow British troops on Nigerian territory after independence. So the opposition parties and social movements and all that in the country, once they discovered that, they mounted a very spirited protest against that treaty. And it was abrogated. Now we're talking of a country that had just got its independence. I don't think anyone would doubt that it was still very vulnerable at that point. But because the people were not having any of that, that treaty had to go, and it went. And what do we find in the last few years? It's African leaders asking for the presence of all kinds of foreign entities, including the Wagner Group from Russia, to come into their countries. Now, if someone wants to describe that as colonialism, they are welcome to it, but I think that would be a misuse of language. And if it is not a misuse of language, then you really don't think anything of African agency. Because what you are saying essentially is, Africans have no say in who comes into their country. And I want to say that that is something that I cannot take. Now to decolonization two. Decolonization two refers to what we have now, where it is contended for an ex-colony to be genuinely, truly, or fully independent, it must not have any. It must forswear, on pain of forever being under the yoke of colonization, any and every cultural, political, intellectual, social, and linguistic artifact, idea, process, institution, and practice that retains even the slightest whiff of the colonial past. So in other words, if after independence, a country has within its life intellectual, practical, moral, political, economic, anything that looks like what used to obtain under colonialism, that is evidence that the country has not become fully decolonized. And I like to use those words, fully, truly, really, because those adverbs come with open-ended, you know, at what point do you say that something is truly, you know, what it is? And of course, you can always expand or contract, you know, those boundaries to suit you. And some people who have argued against my work, you know, they have said, well, you know, you are ignoring cultural appropriation, you know, people come in and when you go to listen to radio stations in Nigeria, they are all in English, or if they are not all in English, they are all playing foreign songs and so on. And I'm going, If they are playing those foreign songs, is this a case of somebody saying from Washington, D.C., you better play our songs? Or might it be a case of international payola? If it is the latter, there's agency involved. If it's the former, no one has yet brought out any evidence, you know, that that is the case. Secondly, people love to talk about religion, which I also love to talk about. And they talk about how Christianity is all over the place, indigenous religions have been wiped out. And I say, okay. But how did Christianity become a foreign religion in Africa? Yes, if you take 1492 and what happened after that at the beginning of your history, Christianity is a foreign religion in Africa. But if you know the history of Christianity, and you know that one of the principal actors in the drama of the crucifixion of Christ was from a place called Cyrenaica. And the last time I looked, Cyrenaica is still in a place called North Africa, Benghazi, Libya, today. Yes, there's always an answer for that, because that's not sub-Saharan Africa. That's not Black Africa. Then I tell them, I got news for you. The idea of separating North Africa from the rest of Africa actually had a racist genealogy in the philosophy of J.W.F. Hegel. And he did it precisely to deny that Egypt was part of Africa. He said, Egypt should be properly regarded as part of what he called European Africa. And I said, okay, so why don't you call southern Italy, Lampedusa, Sicily, African Europe? So again, we're talking about agency. We're talking about taking history very seriously. We're talking about not taking something because it serves political purposes and so on and so forth. Because every time you use the phrase Black Africa or Sub-Saharan Africa, you are actually giving Hegel a victory that he never earned. And there's no place else in the world where you do that. A Nigerian intellectual wrote a very interesting essay called What is Sub-Saharan Africa? And he said, you know, that if we apply the same logic, then we use the Himalayas, you know, in Asia, and then we start talking about what is sub, what is super, you know, Himalayas. We use other deserts, you know, in other parts, you know, Atacama, you know, in South America, and then we begin to, you know, and then use the Alps in Europe. And that's something that you already here can relate to, I'm sure. But things like that do not get through the din of decolonizers because, yes, most of their audience is out here in Europe and America. And I hope that part of the thing that a work like mine does is to force all of you, if you haven't done so already, to take another look at it. Please, my claim here is not about being right. My claim here is not about being correct. My claim is this may not be all that it is cranked up to be. What the alternative will be, people should be open. I know what the alternative is for me. I will just banish the word completely. And I'll give you an example of how some of us have done that without getting into name calling or whatever it is. So just like our eats, a term that can be applied to almost anything, and its deployers all pretend that they know what they are talking about, without more, is one that cannot aid illumination. When we all hearken to the charge to just do it, we assume with no grounds that every it is as good as any other it, and whatever we are doing is it. Here are some ways in which decolonization resembles it. Colonialism is not a monolithic idea. It has had multiple evolutions in human history, including various kinds of colonialism in different parts of Africa among African peoples in history. So colonialism was not imported to Africa. Every time you have empires and states, especially empires and states that are multi-ethnic, multinational, multicultural, there's usually a hint that some kind of colonization has taken place, you know, right there. And again, unless we want to make Africa a simple place where no complexity existed, there is no historical warrant for that kind of orientation. If what I just said is true, then anyone who asks us to decolonize must tell us what colonialism is in play in their discussion. Colonization is not just what the West usually erroneously identifies with Europe did to the rest of us, it is also what in different neighborhoods others have done to their fellows. What this means is that a failure to show the lineaments of the particular colonialism under review vitiates the analysis that is built thereon. And this is where I then throw my challenge to decolonizers, and I will read the challenge from the book, if you don't mind, please. Here is my challenge to prospective decolonizers. When you are inclined, quote unquote, to decolonize X, here are some questions to bear in mind as or before you proceed. First, is X created, caused, determined, conditioned, or influenced by colonialism? We can see from my example of music that the relationship between X and colonialism is really straightforward or clear-cut. And again, I love to use African music as examples, you know, because a whole lot of the African music that everybody now calls African music is hybrid, like most other music that you're going to find anywhere. Does that make them colonial music? And if they are African music, then so why can people not take liberal democracy, borrow it, domesticate it in their environment without having you accuse them of being colonial pawns because they want to run Western institutions? What makes liberal democracy a Western institution? It is not. Second, once we've established X's credentials for decolonizing, we must identify what sort of colonialism we are seeking to rid it of. Third, when X is present in a former colony post-independence, before we rush to decolonize it as a colonial hangover or product, we must consider, and if appropriate, rule out any alternative explanations. Such alternative explanations might include inertia. We are human. Sometimes we just meet something and we just keep using it. And until somebody then comes that is actually able to jolt us out of our complacency, we just think, oh yeah, it's the way it's done, it's the way we do it. Or a choice by the peoples or intellectuals of this ex-colony to domesticate X in their new situation. This is the key one for me. Because, and as I'm speaking to you, I'm finishing a different essay on the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment had always included African participants from the 17th century in a neighboring country from here, Germany, in a place called Halle, where we had Anton Wilhelm Amo, who was, you know. The fact that the annals of the history of philosophy paper over this does not mean it's exactly what happened with feminist philosophy. Women didn't just start doing philosophy when feminism came on the scene. What they did was they started rewriting the history of philosophy, not by inventing women, but by discovering the women who have always been there, but have been ignored. And that's what good scholarship requires us to do, away from ideology and away from scoring points. We need to establish in each case whether X has actually endured because the ex-colonized themselves have embraced it. And if so, we should ask whether this is an embrace which comes from the continuing power of colonialism to bend the will of the colonized, or if it is a case of the ex-colonized choosing, for whatever reason, to preserve eggs. Fourth and finally, given that a positive aim of decolonizing is to restore something to X that was taken away from it by its colonial origins, once we establish that there is a causal connection between X and colonialism, we might discover that in the case of an entire discipline, for example, colonial genealogy by itself means very little. For instance, African anthropologists now do anthropology on their own people with different eyes, you know, from what others are doing. If we are paying attention to what they are producing, another area of paying attention to agency, then all the noise about decolonizing anthropology begins to be less attractive. If you take anthropology strictly to be what colonialism invented, and yes, it was invented under colonialism. Well, it had its going back to Immanuel Kant and anthropology, but in a different sense, but you know, there are connections right there. And the whole business of deciding race and turning Greeks into the forerunners of European philosophy was the creation of the 18th century. We now know that, historically speaking. So we need to take all these complexities, you know, and work with them. How much do I have left? By way of time. It's 10:57. I think I've been talking for about 37 minutes. Okay, yeah, that's what I thought. I said about 37 minutes, right? Yeah, thank you very much. So let me just, I was going to give you an example from music, but I'm going to leave that. The final thing that I would just like to say is that we should never allow people to think that certain ideas belong to certain colors, certain races, certain places. Ideas do not follow geographical boundaries. Yes, ideas do come from particular cultures, but ideas come ultimately from individual minds in conversation with other minds. And whoever is willing to put in the sweat equity to make sense of those ideas, possibly appropriate them, and move them in some other directions, becomes a co-speaker of that language. And for me, that's the way humanity has always rolled. And at no time was Africa outside of the global circuit of ideas. So all it requires us is to really take very seriously what African thinkers have written over the years. That is the ultimate way, if decolonizing has any role to play, when people begin to actually fill out the blank spaces in the annals of intellectual history to reflect how this history has actually been constituted by the variety of peoples who inhabit the world, the job will have been done. Thank you very much for your attention.
Danke, dass du diese Podcast-Episode gehört hast. Ich hoffe, sie hat dir gefallen und du konntest etwas Neues erfahren und lernen. Und wenn du schon mal da bist, lass uns doch eine Bewertung oder ein paar Sternchen da. Das würde uns sehr helfen. Und wenn du mehr Vorträge vom AHA-Festival hören willst, abonniere diesen Podcast und folge uns auf Instagram und Facebook. Auch über Feedback freuen wir uns sehr. Schreib uns eine Mail an am@aha-festival.ch. AHA, ein Podcast für Wissen, ist eine Zusammenarbeit von Christoph Fellmann und mir, Anna Matjaschewicz. Mitproduziert und komponiert hat Nikola Miloš Mišić.